Welcome to the second part of my interview with Jason Jacobs. Jason has very kindly offered his time to provide insights in different aspects of converting a business to cloud from on-premise. And today, one of the issues we are going to be addressing is automation in the sales and marketing process. Channeltivity, Jason's company, is in partner relationship management. It's a self-funded company, so costs are extremely important. And one of the biggest costs for SaaS companies up front is the cost of customer acquisition. And Jason has done a very good job of driving that down through automation in both sales and marketing. So he'll be sharing his insights with us on that today. Jason, how are you today?
Doing great, Harold. How are you?
Great, thank you very much. I'm in Seattle. We've had a wonderful winter, very mild, sunny, not a lot of snow. And so very happy with that. Glad I'm not living in Boston anymore.
And I am no longer living in New York.
So. Oh, really? Okay. But I wanted to start off by turning it over to you to provide us with a little bit of background on Channeltivity, the company, the product, the target market, how you sell your product, just to provide us with a little bit of context for the conversation we'll have a little bit later.
Sure. So Channeltivity was founded in 2007. It was a spin-off of a company in Manhattan that was a web app development company. They built a number of portals and discovered they may have a product on their hand. And so in 2007, a couple of guys got together, and Zach Smith, who's my CTO, and another individual, began building out a partner relationship management application. In 2009, I met these individuals, and in 2010, I took control of the company, and Zach continued to write the product, and he's a brilliant CTO, having worked with several in the past. He'd built a really delightful-to-use application for partner relationship management. He'd written it in .NET. We had a hosting farm, with, you know, big expensive servers in it, only a few of them. They only had three clients at the time. And I joined them in 2010 and began kind of building the playbook, taking you know, a lot of lessons from my first company, which was a SaaS company I started in 2001, venture-backed, astronomical growth for 6 years, unpredictable brick wall in 2008, learned a lot of lessons, got it profitable, and we ultimately exited that. But I took over the day-to-day Channeltivity and began building out the sales process, the pipeline kind of management that I had perfected, or I thought I'd perfected at my first company. Channeltivity is a partner relationship management application. That means that we help customers manage the profiling and recruiting of the partners. The system does, similar to the way a CRM would manage a sales pipeline. This manages a partner pipeline. It helps people profile and make the right decisions for bringing partners on board. It has a business planning module so that they can then plan with these partners. It has resources for them, such as content and a resource library. And kind of where the rubber meets the road is in the three modules that are lead distribution for getting leads that the vendor company has generated into the hands of the partners without losing touch with that lead. Deal registration, so they can see a pipeline for their partners and see who's performing and kind of what the sales pipeline looks like. And then market development fund management, to be able to allocate funds, manage those funds, reimburse those funds with an audit trail. And so that's what we do. We also have the ability to embed custom apps if you have something proprietary for your partners. So it becomes the central place for the partner managers and people to manage the partners and to interact with them, and for the partners to have a place to go to handle all of those different aspects of being a partner.
The target market.
Yeah, our target market, we've stuck exclusively with tech companies. And having my first company sold to retailers who don't understand technology, selling tech to tech companies is just wonderful. Everyone gets it. Our terms and conditions all look the same, so it's fantastic. And we focus on tech companies in the emerging and mid-range. So typically our average customer has under 2,000 partners. In the partner channel world, you seem to have people that are below 1,000 or north of 20,000, and there's not a whole lot of people in the middle. And we all know the companies that have the 20, 30, 40, 50,000. But the emerging and mid-sized company, and even departments of large companies, will use our system to manage a channel program. So you'll see on our website that we have Samsung and Vonage. We have a department of Samsung and Vonage. We're not rolled out across the entire organization. You'll see a lot of companies that you probably don't recognize, but someday, you know, hopefully you will. They're using our system to, you know, exponentially grow by growing the channel. And so that's where we'd like to stick. We just crossed over our 100th client as of February. It was a nice milestone for us.
Nice milestone, indeed, yes.
You know, if you bundled, all of our pricing is on our website. We have a launch package that is for true, you know, 0 to 30 partners. Our pricing is for the enterprise level, which is, you know, once you're north of 30 partners, you kind of can take off the training wheels. And you're going to pick and choose the modules. All of our product is a la carte pricing, so you only pay for what modules you use. And that's been a good model. We also don't charge for users. You can have as many users in this system as you want, because you want as many contacts with your partners as you can possibly have. You don't want to hand them a single generic login. It's sort of like handing your partner a bottleneck. So we don't do user-based pricing. You know, all in, you could max out our system at about $2,500 a month. And so if anyone's interested in our pricing, it is on the website.
That's an important point, because you're looking at a price range of $2,500 and below for a monthly subscription. And that has a dramatic impact on the sales process and the visibility, the sensitivity to sales costs. Yes. Earlier, I was speaking with the CEO of a company that sells more of an enterprise solution. They're moving to the cloud. But for them, they don't really see any changes to the sales process. They're going to be selling, you know, maybe a $300,000 solution with services on-prem, and they might be selling that for $150,000 a year in the subscription model. But it's going to be an enterprise sales process. So automation or driving down the customer acquisition costs aren't that critical for them. But when you get down to the level that you're at, I mean, the nice thing about SaaS is the Scots have a wonderful saying that many a mickle make a muckle, and it all adds up over time. But it takes time to build that up. And in the meantime, you're really sensitive, especially when you're self-funded, to the cost of bringing those customers on board. So if I could ask you to start with just the basics on the one of the key metrics that investors and SaaS companies look at is something called CAC, customer acquisition cost. So could you please just give us a description, a definition of what that means and why it's so important?
And so there's two modes of this. The one, the more attractive looking one, is when you look at the lifetime value of a customer and you compare that revenue stream in net present value dollars. You bring it back to year one and say, what is that cash flow worth to me? And what did I spend to acquire that cash flow? And that therein lies your ratio. The thing that I find a little elusive there is, as an early stage company, you don't know lifetime value. You'd be speculating how long your average client's going to be with you. You won't know till you're 10 years in what the true lifetime value is. So I tend to focus more on a customer acquisition cost, where I focus on the percentage of revenue, or the percentage that I'm spending to acquire that recurring revenue dollar. So if I look at an average client who's, just to make math easy, is spending $24,000 a year with us, and that's what the contract value is, lifetime value, you know, can become elusive. You can say, oh, it's their 10-year lifetime value, and so my customer acquisition costs are really low. You don't know. So to be conservative, what's the first year's contract worth, and what did you pay for that? And so let's say we paid $4,000 of marketing, sales cost.
Right, so that's what I was asking. So what are the components of customer acquisition costs? What are the things that you would put into that? Because you are really looking at an ROI calculation, aren't you? How much are you spending up front in order to bring a customer on board? And then over time, how much money are you getting back in to monetize that investment and give you a return on investment? But what are the components that you see being part of CAC? Is it overhead? Is it only the direct marketing? Is it commissions? What are the things that you build into the total customer acquisition costs?
Okay, so I'm kind of a purist here, and I look purely at sales and marketing. And it's similar to the old model. You know, we looked at customer, everyone looked at what is their, with old enterprise sales, that we would look and say, okay, what was our revenue this year for, software licenses and services, and, what do we pay out? And a typical ratio there was like, 20% of your new business should be your marketing budget, 20-25%. And so nothing's really changed there. You're still looking at the revenue acquisitions, just that the revenue numbers are smaller than they used to be. And so, you know, you look back in the day when NetSuite was going public, back in my old company, we were spending about a dollar for every recurring revenue dollar that we would get. So, you know, that was seemingly expensive, but prior to going public, NetSuite was spending about $2.50. But when you look at that, you say, that's crazy. Why would I spend $2 to get a recurring revenue dollar? Well, when the market is telling you that your recurring revenue is worth, that the value of your company is 8 times your recurring revenue, you say, I will spend a dollar to get a dollar that's worth $8.
Right.
And so, the same logic that got us into trouble in 1999. So, I did that at my first company, and what I found was that, you start looking at all the sales and marketing costs. And the important thing is to really get an understanding of the different activities that you're doing. Not every lead is created equal. And so, the best leads I have found at the base of this pyramid of what is inbound lead generation is the singularly, for our SaaS company where cash flow is an issue, it is the best mechanism, the cheapest mechanism for acquiring new customers. Now, you're going to miss a lot of the market. Like in the beginning, we did a survey, we found out that people looking for partner management solutions, 85% of them went to their IT department to have them build them something. 15% went on to Google and said, fix this, and found us. But when they do find us, they know what their problem is. They know what solutions they're looking for. The sales cycle is very short. A short sales cycle means lower cost sales cycle. If it takes someone 45 days to close a deal versus 6, versus 90 days, you've got half the sales costs in there.
I want to drill down on that for just a second, and that is what the role of marketing is today in the sales process versus the way it used to be. So if you look at on-prem, the classic model is that marketing is to drive awareness, create a lead, and then they throw the lead over the fence to the sales team, and the sales team takes over. So if you look at all of the steps in the funnel, marketing is at the front end. Do you see that in the SaaS environment that's changing? Is marketing becoming more of a sales tool? And how are you handling that?
Well, I would say marketing is still in the business of awareness. And in this case, with inbound lead generation, making sure that your search terms are bringing you up. A lot of search engine optimization, a lot of pay-per-click for that type of model. The different layers on the pyramid, it's actually the guy who wrote the book on this is a guy from Matrix Partners, David Skulk.
Yeah, and I've got a lot of his stuff.
He's got some great content on how it breaks down. And at the base is the inbound lead generation, highest effectiveness, because you're not going out and educating people. They're doing the self-educating. And that's what's changed a lot. So when I started with this, 15% of the people were going to the Google and trying to find it. Now it's about 50% because there's an awareness. And so if you're in a burgeoning, new business where people don't know to even search for, they don't even know they're in the pain that you're solving, that exists, your cost of customer acquisition is going to go way up. When you're evangelizing, so my first company, multi-channel retail management, everyone's like, the .com was a failure, don't worry about that. I'm like, no, you're going to need a system that manages your websites and Amazon and eBay. And I evangelized for 3 years, and it was a very, very low profit business because I was going outbound and telling people that they were going to need something 3 years from now. And luckily, we made it work. Channel-tivity has been the opposite. We've gone in and said, here's a handful of key search terms that people are looking for. The number of people going and searching is going to grow over time as the acronym PRM becomes embedded. And so that's helpful. If you don't have a three-letter acronym, your cost of customer acquisition just went up. That's what we've done. Is we've built a machine that brings in a good number, like right now, 60 new leads on average every month, all qualified. So we're not getting people coming to us, filling out a lead form, and they totally misunderstood what it is we do.
So can you walk me through the process then? So you've generated a lead through, let's say, Google AdWords. Somebody's been looking for PRM. They found you. They land on your website. So can you walk me through the steps that they would go through in order to become either more self-educated or more self-qualifying? And is there a step at which a salesperson actually gets involved? So you can just take me through the conversion process and without necessarily naming a brand, but the types of tools that you use to automate those processes.
Okay. So, on the front end, we've got a solution that kind of measures where things come from and website activity and the track people go on. Website conversion is a pretty obvious thing. Things that have helped us convert. One, we freely offer our pricing, so people are fully educated on what they're looking at here. It's surprising. Most people don't really research your website the way we think they do. They think they're going through all this content we wrote about the product. That content about the product is probably the thing that made the search engines get them there. People tend to not want to read like infographics, and they want to get into the software and play with it. And today, software has to be intuitive. I was the extreme example I use for scalability. Cost of customer acquisition is akin to scalability of a company. And the example I give to people, I said, do you remember when that pesky Facebook sales guy called you, telling you need to sign up for Facebook? And they're like, no. I said, do you remember that brutal implementation of Facebook? They're like, no. I said, exactly. It's intuitive and it sells itself. And so that's the holy grail. As close as you can get to that, your cost of customer acquisition has gone way down. Obviously in business software, it's not going to reach that. But
Well, so what are the types of things that you use then to automate the process, to make people more self-qualified? Let's use an example. Do you use freemium? Is that part of your model? And what are your thoughts on freemium?
I think freemium is great for relatively simple applications that don't require a lot of implementation or thought to set up. Though our system is completely self-enabled in terms of content, people, you don't need a database admin to do anything in our system if you want to configure it. You still need that. You're still going to need some support to help them get up to speed. So the tools so freemium works great for things like Basecamp. I can get into it. I can figure out how to use it. There's six functions. It's awesome. And when I want to start adding more projects, I start paying for it. It's also
there is some confusion sometimes. What's the difference between freemium and free trials? And freemium is limited functionality of a product for an unlimited duration. So examples are Evernote, Dropbox. They have a base version of the product that you can use forever, but there are some limitations. And the free trial is typically full function for limited duration, typically 30 days, and increasingly is 14 days. If they don't trigger it in 14 days, and but it's not an unlimited use of the product. So, right. But from your perspective, do you think there's a benefit to one over the other?
I think freemium is much better. Free trial, and again, not all software is created equal. So my example with Basecamp is it's freemium. You can manage up to 5 projects, I think, and don't have to pay for it. You've got to put a 6th one on there. Now you got to start paying. And it works. It especially works when the product has had you embed stuff that you are now using in your daily life, and that once it reaches a certain point, you start paying for it. Free trials, so Channeltivity requires a thought process on implementation. It's a thought process that customers can go through by themselves. They don't require services to do it, so it is self-enabled. But they've got to think of how they're going to set up their recruiting process, how they're going to set up their deal reg process, and they've got to configure the system. And so that's a lot of work. And so if we do a free trial, we offered a 30-day free trial. It wasn't met with a lot of fanfare. People are like, I want to look at the system and I'll decide if I want to buy it or not. So we didn't offer a freemium model because I wasn't thinking. I thought, let's do a 30-day free trial and get them hooked. It really doesn't work that way. What we do is we have a sandbox that allows people to go in and in a system that requires a lot of data to understand how it's working. It's like a CRM. You look at it when it's out of the box, it's empty. It's a it's a big holding vessel for data, and you can figure out how you want to structure the holding vessel, and that requires a lot of thought. So similar with our system, people just want to see it populated. So with a business system that's going to manage relationships and be a relatively large enterprise level system, I think a freemium model or a free trial is difficult, because if you're managing sensitive data, if you're putting data in, you're not going to get a sense of how the system really works without putting a great degree of effort in. And so with enterprise software, we found that 30-day free trial is not terribly popular. Our sandbox, really popular. It's 80%, maybe 90% of our conversion from the website is through our sandbox.
That's a really good observation, Jason. And we see the same thing, that there's a real distinct difference between products. So freemium works really well at the low end with a very simple self-service product, but typically where there's a very large market, because the conversion rate for freemium is between 1 and 3%. So if you start to multiply that out, you really need to have a product where you have potentially millions and millions of subscribers, things like Dropbox, things like Evernote. And then the 30-day free trial also needs to be self-service. But when you get into things like ERP, accounting, CRM, PRM, people want to see their own data, which means that there is going to be something of a project involved in setting up the sandbox so that customers and prospects can see it. Now, that also means that there needs to be some level of human intervention. So at the, in your process, at what point does a salesperson get involved? Do you do lead scoring? So if a Samsung pops in and they start doing some self-service and exploring your content, does a salesperson jump on and follow up with them? What criteria do you use for actually involving a human resource in the sales process?
One of the things we try to do here, we tell everybody, we're not in the business of selling our application. We're in the business of making sure that it's a good fit and you understand what it does. And as a result of that, we have literally 100% referenceable client base, because we allow them the time to play with it, and we allow them to play with it and not disturb them. And so I think if you go on our site today, you'll see the form for the sandbox. And it says, don't worry, we're not going to call you. You're not going to get some person jumping on you the moment. You'll get an email that says, thank you for logging into the sandbox. Here's your login credentials. Please let us know if you have any questions. We do lead score, but we don't care what the name is. We don't get too excited when it's a big company name, because we're targeted at the mid and emerging market, and the brand name doesn't dictate any different pricing. They're nice marquee names to have, but our process is very regimented in terms of how we qualify a lead. Everyone's got a sort of a different flavor of this. But, if they're a qualified business, meaning they're in our target market, they're in our range, they're building channel, they've kind of got all the elements, we know that they're qualified, and we want to help educate them as best we can. And so typically what happens is they log into the sandbox. We can see their login activity, and we can tell who's interested. We do send an email out just to be cordial and let them know that they're not just logging into some empty room here. And with that typically quick turnaround is they go into the sandbox, they verify that, okay, this is something I want further information on. Then they'll reach out, respond to that email and say, I'd like to set up a demonstration, or I'd like to know what your pricing is. And we send that. And so it's a very sort of consultative process to make sure that one, they're in the right industries. So I mentioned before that we try to stick exclusively to tech companies, because there's always nuances in other industries. And so though telecommunications looks awesome, it's a big market, they're regulated and their pricing models are regulated, and it enters in a whole lot of functionality that we don't currently have, and nor do we want to build it. And so we stick pretty closely to that market, and as such, we don't care who the name is. We don't treat them any differently. The important thing about your funnel is that you treat everyone equally with the same criteria. You don't leave somebody at a sales stage just because they've got a big name and because you're hopeful. The criteria of being in a sales stage, an active sales stage, is interaction and interest. And criteria to exit is either out the bottom, that they're not a good fit now, in which case we've usually connected with them on through a LinkedIn group or something, and we'll they'll keep hearing our name, and when they're ready, they'll come and get us. I did away with the belief that I could accelerate sales funnels. People buy in this day and age; they buy in the time they're going to buy.
And that's really the buzzword today in marketing. It's a buyer-centric marketing. It's a buyer's journey. It's not a sales process anymore. Companies do want to be self-educating. They'll do their research. They get much further along in the decision-making process before they actually reach out to a potential vendor. And one of the key components from a lot of marketing recommendations is content marketing. And you made an interesting comment that you put all this content out on the website, but people don't really want to spend time reading it. But it does help drive the leads. So how do you use content marketing as part of the mix?
So we're not doing anything terribly innovative there that everyone else isn't doing. We're trying to write meaningful blog posts. We try to ensure that the content on our website speaks in the language that is relevant to the search engine terms that we want to achieve. I'm hoping that we've really wrung the sponge dry on all this stuff, because every year there seems to be the next big thing, the silver bullet that's going to really change the game. And in the end, everyone's trying to game the Google algorithm and get that top ranking. And I think Zuckerberg said it, this stuff's going to go away. It used to matter how many Facebook likes you had. It would have some impact, and that went away. And so everyone's just trying to, the cycle times are getting, I think they're down to like 3 months now on a new strategy. And so I've been pretty parochial about it. I don't want to put out content for the sake of putting out content. I put out content that I expect, if someone read it, they wouldn't go, oh my God, this person totally worded this thing for a bot and not for a human. And that's a lot of that going on. So I've just shied away from that. We stick to good practices of putting out good content on our blog, relevant content on our website. Never really got on any of the bandwagons. It's helpful that our all of our portals are out there. They reference Channeltivity. And so the nature of our growing client base helps me get more business, because that's a good thing. If someone's looking for Google's whole business is, I need to make sure that that thing that pops up there is the thing this person wants, because people get really upset when the results have been gamed, mm-hmm. And that's Google's whole battle. And so we try to stick to the what they call the white hat side of this completely. I've shied away from any, get the emails that we can get you in the top 10. You can. You can also get blacklisted. So we tend to stick to pretty basic content marketing that we think is good content for readers. And then time in the saddles is what's going to matter. We've been in PRM, out there with a brand name and a URL for 7 years now, 8 years. And so that helps. And the other thing that helps is partners. That link sharing between your partner and your site. So I list my tech partners and referral partners on my site, and I link to their website, and they link back to me. There's another PRM vendor in the space called Relayware. They sell way upstream from us. And the CEO and I got together, and I said we should represent each other on our sites, because none of your leads are good for me, and none of my leads are good for you. And that alone, with two relevant companies in the same space sharing those backlinks, that's relevant stuff, because it means your credibility's there. You should come up when someone's looking for a PRM, and if you're not coming up, Google's making a mistake.
Or you are. Jason, this has been really helpful. We see a lot of companies that are moving from on-prem where they look at their SaaS offering as a way of entering a newer market. So they might be selling a $30,000, $50,000 on-prem solution to the mid-market, and where they see the SaaS offering as really a way of moving down to an entry-level market. And at that point, they can't use the same sales and marketing strategy that they've had in the past. So this has been very helpful. You've provided some very specific suggestions, things that have worked for you, things to watch out for. Just on a parting note, do you have any final suggestions or recommendations for companies when it comes to sales and marketing automation if they're moving into this part of the business?
The only thing is that if you're doing that mid-market play going down SaaS to get into the smaller market, it's a very different sell cycle. you almost have to put that in a different building because I've seen this happen a lot. An on-prem company will buy a SaaS company as a means of getting in, and within 9 months, that thing just doesn't exist. It's on a shelf. It's very difficult. They're very different companies. And so if that's your strategy to migrate into this, it's going to be a hard play. You need a very different, you can't apply the same sales and marketing tactics. Anything above inbound lead gen, which I focused on, gets more expensive to acquire. Outbound calling, we don't do it. When you do outbound calling, you're presenting to somebody a solution, and to do that, you have to kind of probe them and see if they've got a pain. And what they remember about you is that you're the guy who illustrated the water they were drowning in. and they're usually extremely longer sell cycles. So our sell cycle is about 45 days. So people are coming to us with a known need, and they're looking for a solution, and they've usually got budget. In an outbound, it could be a year to a year and a half before the person reconciles, okay, yeah, that guy was right. And it's a pretty low probability that you reach out to somebody, and it just so happens they were looking for a system but already hadn't gone to Google. Very low population. The Venn diagram on there very barely goes over each other. If you call them and know they're in pain, they were already searching. And so that works. Awareness works. Speaking, being the thought leader in the industry. I'm sort of the anti-thought leader in the channel industry because I don't believe in the next big thing, the next buzz. I believe in sticking to good, solid business practices and building relationships, and that's what builds the channel. And that we keep layering technology in between us and our channel partners. And it, every year, it's proving to each new promise isn't working. So.
Well, again, this has been really good, and I think that's a nice way to wrap it up, and that is that business fundamentals don't change that much. Technology enables a lot of these processes, and you've done a really good job of describing how you're using technology to enable your sales and marketing to drive down the customer acquisition costs, make the whole process more efficient. So we really appreciate you sharing your time and your insights with us today, Jason. Thanks.
Thank you, Harold.